You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, you're listening to the Cycling Podcast. My name's Lionel Burney, and no Daniel Freiber this week because he is at the podcasting equivalent of the Tour of the Alps, fine-tuning his fitness, resting his voice ahead of the Giro d'Italia, which starts on Friday, May the 8th, in, logically enough, Bulgaria. Of course, we're used to these overseas starts to the Giro d'Italia these days. One man who'll be there in Bulgaria and then in Italy for the Giro d'Italia is Tudor Pro Cycling's Larry Warbass. And Larry, you've just finished training and I'm interrupting your refueling. I'm sorry about that. But what are you tucking into after training today?
So today, hey everyone, good to be back. Just finished my training session. So was eating actually some oats with raspberries, some dried cranberries, actually added a little special flavor today with a pistachio cream. You know, it's like the pistachio equivalent of Nutella. It's probably not very healthy and probably doesn't really help my recovery any, but it tastes really good. So, and then, yeah, egg white omelet. So, you know, trying to stay lean.
It's coming up to 2:45 there in the afternoon, Larry, in Nice, where you are. I mean, that sounds like breakfast to me, but I mean, breakfast is the meal of kings, right?
Yeah, I also ate it for breakfast, to be honest. So I don't know. Some days I like my oatmeal a lot. So I just eat it for breakfast and lunch.
And so very quickly, what are we? 10 days out from the start of the Giro d'Italia. So what did your training session look like this morning?
Well, I actually did half of Liège after Tour of the Alps. So still kind of resting a bit. I mean, today I did 3 hours, so it's not exactly rest, but Monday I took off. Tuesday, yes, I just did an hour easy. And then today was like 2 hours easy on the road and then an hour heat on the home trainer. So in a heat suit, research has shown lately that you can extend the benefits of altitude and keep the hemoglobin mass, which is one of the biggest benefits of altitude, longer by doing heat training. So it's not exactly fun, but it's effective. So yeah, did an hour session on the home trainer.
I'm imagining a heat suit. Is it full length? Is it like, I don't know, I'm imagining one of those, you know, those big sumo wrestler suits that you see, or the Michelin man, or is it more like a sort of scuba diver suit?
Well, actually, a scuba diving suit would work really well, but it is the one that I use and that most people use is essentially a hazmat suit. It's like a paint suit, but like to the next level. So some guys, they use just a paint suit, which actually isn't very good because normally they're breathable. So you want one that's like chemical grade or whatever. So it's absolutely not breathable at all. And it's just like, it's essentially just wearing like a plastic garbage bag. And then usually I have like tights or like, and then a long sleeve base layer. Then I put a hat on, then I put a down jacket over that, and then you ride. So it's really, really hot.
Well, if there's anything that guarantees terrible weather at the Giro d'Italia, it's you doing a load of heat training 10 days out from the
exactly.
race. So we'll look forward to the rain and the miserable weather at the Giro. Hopefully not. Where you were last week, Larry, the Tour of the Alps, I mean, it looked absolutely glorious again. It's a race that you did last year. It's a race that really seems to suit your team, Tudor Pro Cycling, because you had another stage win this year. Someone who more at home on the ice. Tell us about your young, not quite so young teammate, because he rides for the development team, but he's 25 years old, relatively new to cycling, and he won one of the stages.
Yeah, exactly. So his name is Leonard Yash. He's, yeah, I believe 25. So, but he's only been riding a bike for maybe 3 years now. So very, very new to cycling. He was a high level speed skater. He was probably one of the better speed skaters in Germany. He competed internationally. His parents are actually coaches for the German speed skating team. And his sister is also a professional speed skater. She raced in the Olympics just a little bit ago. We raced Oman together and he went straight from Oman to watch his sister in the Olympics. So that was kind of cool. This year he came to our first training camp. I don't know, there were rumors that maybe he had already signed for the team. We weren't sure or not. I hope that he did, actually. But regardless, you know, we noticed like pretty quickly he had actually quite a good level, you know, in all the training rides. So usually they don't bring Devo guys to the pro team camp, but they brought him. And yeah, you could see that, you know, he was pretty strong. And he also has really good kick on him. Ended up racing Oman with him and then also here in Alpe Maritime in Tour de Var. So I've actually raced him quite a bit, but I have to say in Tour of the Alps, he definitely had another level than he had before. So last year he was on the Bora development team, and he decided to come to our team because he thought he had a better shot at going pro with our team than he did with Bora. So seems like actually that was the right decision. And yeah, so he hasn't done too many races with the Devo team, but he's done quite a few with us. And he did Kopi Bartoli with the Devo team, but I think that might be it. You know, already I knew that, like, he was a solid rider. In the last races, I didn't see anything that I was like, oh my gosh. But he had a good level. He was always there. So, you know, going into Tour of the Alps, we were like, okay, cool, you know. It's not like sometimes you bring a Devo guy and, you know, they're in way over their head. So we knew that, you know, he wouldn't be in over his head. The rest of us were coming from altitude. So we were like, okay, you know, cool. You know, he'll be a good help. And so the first day, or I don't know, maybe the first like mountaintop finish, we were like, okay, like if you can ride to bring back the break with one of our other guys. So this guy started riding and everyone in the bunch was like, who the heck is riding? Like it was so hard, you know? I mean, the pace was insane and everyone, all of us were just suffering so much in the bunch. We were like, wow, these guys are really going hard, you know? And then after he pulled for maybe like 45 minutes, an hour, we wanted to do the lead into the climb. And then, so he just got on the front and we were on his wheel. I was on his wheel. And I mean, there were teams just like burning guys next to this kid. And he'd already been riding the front and he was just staying on the front while all these other teams, they had to rotate next to him. And we were like, wow, this guy's like really strong, you know? Then the day after, he did this crazy job in the final. Like, I mean, the bunch split in half with like a few K to go. And all of a sudden, like no one could close it. Leonard came around out of nowhere and just closed the gap. And then we were trying to ride the front into the sprint. He came out of nowhere again and was pulling. And we were like, wow, like this kid's really good, you know? And after that stage, I had a chat with him. And I was like, have you signed for the team yet? He's like, no, I haven't. I was like, okay, well, I'm definitely going to talk to them because like you deserve to be a pro. Like you are really strong, you know, like we were like really impressed. So like, yeah, okay, I'm going to call someone on the team because like you need to be a pro, you know? And then the next day he goes and he just absolutely smashes his breakaway. And so then it was funny. I was like, okay, well, I guess I don't need to tell anyone now, but he told everyone himself, but it was also funny because on this day, on one climb, I think 50K to go, he dropped everyone that he was with. And then the director, we could hear in the radio going, Leonard, like, don't go alone. Don't go alone. Like, pretend you're suffering. Like, let them catch you. Make it look like you're suffering, you know? So then he waited for them, and he was looking like he's suffering. And then the next climb, boom, he drops everyone and then solos to the wind. So, see, that was pretty funny. But, yeah, impressive riding from him. And I hope for the team that they already signed him because he's super good.
I thought you were going to say this is the first step onto a post-cycling career as a rider agent. You should be asking for a cut, some kind of signing bonus.
Exactly.
Well, we'll return to the Tour of the Alps, which was won by Giulio Pellizzari of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. He also took a couple of stages. We'll talk about the Tour of the Alps in part three in a bit more detail because it was kind of the lead up to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Larry, which you mentioned, the latest stop on the Paul Sexas hype train. And we'll see what the Tour of the Alps tells us about the Giro d'Italia and a little bit more about your week there, because it was another good week for Tudor as you tune up for the Giro d'Italia. But in the next part, I'll enlighten everybody on what happened in central London yesterday. I travelled into London for a press slash kind of corporate schmooze that the Ineos Grenadiers team were hosting to unveil their new sponsor. And well, if we didn't wonder what AI's role in the future of professional cycling might be, we've got a few more clues after yesterday. So I'll fill Larry in. You're probably still okay, you athletes. I think you'll survive, but I think AI is going to help make some decisions on and off the bike. If Net Company, the new title sponsor of the Ineos team, is going to have the influence on the sport that they want to have. So we'll talk about that in just a mo.
Shoot, Suite à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network that there is. And as we are approaching Grand Tour season, Daniel will be off around Bulgaria and Italy, and no doubt he will have his NordVPN on his laptop and his phone. I also have NordVPN activated on all of my devices that are connected up to the internet, primarily for the purposes of security. I want to keep all of my data safe and secure. There are side benefits too to having a NordVPN subscription. Sometimes you can buy things online a bit cheaper, particularly airline flights, hotel rooms, by switching your location and shopping around. That can be one of the benefits. And also when you're traveling abroad, perhaps for work or on holiday, and you want to keep in touch with your favorite sporting events or carry on watching your favorite streaming services, you can switch your location as if you're back at home and carry on watching uninterrupted if things are geo-restricted. But the primary benefit is the internet security. It protects you from viruses, phishing attempts, and malware. And just means that if you do inadvertently click on one of those spam emails that's trying to hoodwink you into surrendering any of your information, NordVPN has your back and will keep you protected. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP. If you use that URL, you'll get a great deal on a 2-year plan. You'll get 4 months extra for free at nordvpn.com/TCP. It's risk-free as well. So if it's not for you, very unlikely, I know, you can get your money back within 30 days. NordVPN.com/TCP. So, Larry, we have been aware that the Ineos Grenadiers team, owned by Jim Ratcliffe, the petrochemical billionaire, have been looking for partners to, I guess, sort of share the load of funding the cycling team. We know that Jim Ratcliffe's got his hands full with Manchester United Football Club, which Ineos Sport co-owns, and the cycling team has been bringing on board other sponsors, notably Total Energies came on board last year, and a couple of weeks ago, probably last month I think it was, the news broke that a Danish IT company, Net Company, was in the prime seat to become the title sponsor of the Ineos Grenadiers team. And so it has turned out to be the case, because yesterday in central London at Via Atelier, which is a very nice cycling cafe in London's King's Cross, if anyone's in the area, I recommend you drop in there and then pop over the road to Vermuteria, which is where the Cycling Podcast used to record episodes way back in the day when we all lived in and around London. Anyway, I went along to Via Atelier, and as I say, it wasn't really a press launch. It was kind of a combination of sort of corporate unveiling and an opportunity to listen to the founder and CEO of Net Company, a Danish cycling fan and tech wizard called Andre Rogaczewski. Sir Dave Brailsford, the team principal of Ineos Grenadiers, and the director of racing, Geraint Thomas. Now, they didn't confirm the level of investment, but they didn't deny that the figures that have been reported were inaccurate either. So it's thought to be around about 100 million euros over the next 5 years. And it means that the team becomes Net Company Ineos from the Giro d'Italia, which starts on Friday, May the 8th. They unveiled their new jersey. I don't know whether I'm slightly colorblind, but I can't work out whether it's green grey or blue grey or just grey grey. And Net Company itself is a tech company, and it's made huge strides in AI with its Pulse software, which is used at Copenhagen and Heathrow airports, and also by His Majesty's Revenue and Customs. So it's keeping an eye on all of our tax details and data as well. And we've talked on the podcast about the growing influence of artificial intelligence in sport. And it was quite interesting to hear Andre Rogaczewski explain why cycling was so interesting to him, not just because he is a fan of the sport, but because of the blizzard of data, so much data generated by the riders, the logistics as well of running a cycling team, getting everybody where they need to be, getting all the equipment where it needs to be. He said it's a huge data project, and the idea is that AI can help to make better decisions more often. He was quite keen to sort of stress that it isn't about artificial intelligence replacing human instinct or the beauty of sport. And certainly I thought it was quite clever that they had Geraint Thomas there talking about his interactions with technology. I mean, he did say at one point he only got a laptop when he retired, and he's not really a techie guy. I'm not sure I believe that, but he also said he struggles to set up his Apple TV. But I mean, he hosts a podcast, and as I'm sure you can imagine, everyone, it takes a tech wizard to run the Cycling Podcast, so I'm sure Geraint knows his way around a computer. But he was definitely kind of emphasizing this marriage of science and art in professional cycling. Anyway, it's a significant amount of money. I suppose the biggest question is how much of that is in addition to what Ineos is going to continue spending, or is this allowing Ineos Grenadiers to reduce its expenditure on the cycling team whilst retaining the ownership? We don't really know the answer to that, but certainly we can assume that it's a decent injection of cash for a team that has been kind of wavering a little bit, certainly been overtaken by UAE Team Emirates. And they've lost the Tour de France crown, haven't won it since Egan Bernal won in 2019. That was the first year that the team was branded Ineos after Jim Ratcliffe's takeover, remember. An awful lot has happened since then, but they now have their sights set on the Tour de France again. I mean, to my ears, it seemed a fairly modest target. They want to win the Tour de France within the next 5 years. That is the length of the commitment from net company Ineos. But then when you look at their current roster, Larry, and see how the other teams are stacking up at the moment, it does look a bit like, if you haven't got Tadej Pogacar, Jonas Vingegaard or Paul Sexas, who's suddenly announced his arrival on the scene, winning the Tour de France is a big challenge. And it won't surprise you, Larry, to know that already the rumours are that net company Ineos would certainly be rivaling UAE Team Emirates were Paul Sexas to be wriggled out of his decathlon contract early, or when that contract expires at the end of next year. So all change at Ineos. We're going to have to get used to calling them net company Ineos. We're going to have to get used to looking out for the grey-blue jersey. But this thing about AI, Larry, I'm just wondering, have you come into contact with AI at all? Does your team use it? Does it shape your training? Does it shape the logistics, the racing at all?
Personally, I like to ask a lot of questions. You know, I mean, I'm someone who I'm super interested in training and, you know, the latest research and everything like that. I guess in the past, I'd always have to really like comb the internet for all this stuff, for research studies, things, you know, like, I don't know, simple questions about like, you know, how to approach altitude, you know, essentially, you know, or for example, recently we were at altitude and, you know, there's a lot of research on like how to take iron at altitude, because like iron supplementation is extremely important at altitude to get these hemoglobin mass gains that you're searching for. For example, I would ask various different AIs, you know, to essentially comb like the latest research and give me a summary of what the best practices are for supplementation of iron while at altitude, you know? So I would use it for things like that personally, essentially asking it questions that otherwise I would have to search the internet for a super long time to find this information. And of course we have nutritionists, things like that, but like I prefer to actually read all this stuff myself. I have heard like inklings, like some teams are using AI for training, like UAE, stuff like that. To what extent, I'm not totally sure. I wouldn't say our team's definitely not using it for training or anything. It hasn't totally come into the sport so much yet. I mean, I know there's this new training software that, you know, looks like it's trying to become like a Training Peaks rival called like Vecta. And I know they use AI for all these insights, but without a doubt, as you explained, I mean, we record so much data, and to be honest, 80% of the data we record, we don't do anything with. So it would be very interesting to have some sort of program that could synthesize all this data and give us actionable insights from it, you know? So, you know, I would say probably 70% of the riders use a wearable, whether that's an Oura Ring or a Whoop or something like that. So most people are tracking their sleep, their HRV with that, I guess then also their resting heart rate. We obviously have all the power data, heart rate data, Some teams are measuring their breathing data, stuff like that. So, I mean, we have so many different things we're using to measure everything that's happening in our body. But, you know, for example, I started to measure HRV in like 2015, 2016. I've probably measured it, let's say, two-thirds of the time since then. Not once in my life have I ever changed my training because of what the HRV said. So essentially, I've tracked this metric for years and I've done literally nothing with it, you know? So at least, I mean, I know what, when I'm fresh, I know when I'm not fresh, things like that, and what those numbers sort of show. But like, if you're not actually doing anything with it, then what's the point, right? So it would be cool to actually get some better insight into that. And I'm sure if you use AI well, it can give you a lot more detailed insights and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, HRV, heart rate variability, right? And that indicates whether you're getting sick or tired, potentially, or whether your form's coming on. And so you've got 7 years of data that could be analyzed to predict, you know, how you respond to training and how you respond to certain circumstances. And I think what I came away from the presentation realizing was the difference between the sort of AI, the generative AI, which is where, you know, you're basically asking whether it's ChatGPT or something to scrape the internet for knowledge that already exists and then present an answer. And then you're like, well, is this the right answer or not?
Yeah, that's also a very big problem.
Yeah, of course. This is much more kind of like predicting based on, you know, the data that's available. And as both Andre Rogaczewski and Dave Brailsford said, you know, there's a blizzard of data and it's about how you sort and how you kind of find out answers or see sort of diamonds in the rough from all of this information, you know, what's relevant, what isn't relevant, and sorting out what could lead to some kind of performance gain or operational gain. At the end, we did ask the guy from Net Company, Andre Rogaczewski, what would be the kind of the first step, and he was saying it would be the sort of low-hanging fruit was the way he described it, of just sorting out the vast logistics of running the team.
Yeah. I mean, that I think there's a lot of progress that can be made because the logistics are ridiculous in a cycling team. And it's crazy to think that pretty much each team just has like one person handling logistics and for everything, you know? And I'm sure AI, that you could use AI to, I mean, optimize this so much more. And I also think logistics is somewhere where you can gain a lot of performance as well by optimizing travel and travel days and, you know, how to most efficiently get to and from races, things like that, and with minimizing the amount of travel. And, you know, you could sort of put in all these criteria. It can even have to do with sleep and, you know, what time you're leaving, things like that, and like how much you want to be before a race. I mean, for sure, logistics is an area ripe for overhaul in cycling.
Well, that's exactly what Pulse does. I mean, it runs a couple of international airports. I mean, Heathrow, the contract with Heathrow is huge, and Heathrow is one of the biggest airports in the world. And, you know, I mean, he didn't go into detail about how it operates in an airport setting, but you can imagine, you know, if a plane is late, that has a lot of knock-on consequences. You know, is the fuel in the right place? Is the steps in the right place? Are the staff ready? You know, how does that change the passengers' journey through the airport as they're arriving? And while he was talking, there was a kind of a screen behind him sort of flashing up, looked a bit like an app, but with lots of sort of cycling related things dropping in, you know, almost like a sort of social media feed, you know, rider sick, travel plan change, training altered, you know. And I can imagine that they will get to work pretty soon on rolling that out and sort of streamlining and reducing the friction in actually running the team. And one example that he cited was, you know, if a rider's sick and has to pull out of a race, you know, what does AI say about who's the best rider, not just in terms of where they are in the world and how they would get to the race, but you know, who's best suited to fill that slot. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the AI makes a decision, but it might shape the way that the people who are making that decision look at making the best decision in those circumstances. I suppose where I was most interested was like, how would this change racing? You know, could it be used to analyze race situations, weather, historical data, climbing times on particular climbs? You know, has the gap got too big? Can this stay away? All of that kind of thing, predicting and modeling in real time what's going on in the race. I mean, that seems to me to be the words they used actually were asset and weapon. Like, this could be a real asset, or could it be something to be used in the kind of the tech performance arms race that's undoubtedly going on?
That's, for me, I think, also one of the most interesting areas that has not been adequately analyzed, at least from my perspective, is, like, for example, predicting when and how a breakaway can stay away. You know, surely there are some sort of scenarios that, if you analyze, you know, historical data, essentially can tell you when or how, like, a breakaway is going to stick. You know, okay, the problem is, cycling has definitely changed a lot. So I don't know how far we could even go back historically, because, you know, every year the way the style of racing is changing. But I'm sure there are some things, there are some different scenarios that, you know, the problem is it has to do with GC, then who's in the break, then how strong they are, things like that. But I'm really quite confident that there are certain days and certain scenarios where, you know, if you really synthesize all this data, it could sort of tell you, like, today the breakaway will stick, or, you know, there's an 87% chance that the breakaway will go to the finish today. And then you're like, damn, we better put some guys in the breakaway, you know? And I'm sure then, once you're in the breakaway, I'm sure with all the data it could analyze, it could tell you, like, okay, you know, this is the time gap you need, or, like, this is the best scenario to win the race. You know, maybe you need to escape with a certain amount of guys after a certain amount of time, you know, things like that. So, I mean, there's such a crazy amount of data. Now, how to enter all that in, I have no idea. You know, I mean, I don't know if you could just, like, feed it in. I have no idea how you could feed it all that information from the past, but I'm sure somehow you could.
Be difficult for the sports directors, you know, driving around corners and analyzing all this data. I mean, we've seen that role has changed now. Normally the lead sports director, certainly in the Grand Tours and the major classics, won't be driving the car. They'll be sitting in the passenger seat. I mean, you mentioned that about, can AI predict whether the brake will stay away, or whether it's a good day for the brake? I mean, Matt White can do that. You know, definitely think that somebody might be able to eke out some performance gains, you know, on quite a consistent basis, if, you know, and I think this was where, you know, Dave Brailsford, this is absolute manna from heaven for him. This is kind of how he has run his entire sports career, in the sort of looking for the phrase way back in the day was the marginal gains. How do you improve in lots of areas by a small amount to add up to a big gain? And I mean, there were things from the past that were sort of coming back to me. I remember when they launched Team Sky in 2010, they'd analysed all this weather data to choose the best location for their pre-season training camp. And they chose, from memory, I think it was somewhere near Valencia on the coast. And it was only when they got there, yes, if the weather was fine, it was just the training wasn't as good as it was in the places where everyone else went, you know, further south, Calpe or wherever. And then the 2010 Tour de France, where they tapped into the knowledge of the British sailing team for the weather conditions in Rotterdam ahead of the time trial, basically the weather forecast was completely wrong. And it, you know, it's easy to kind of sort of mock this attempt to find gains where perhaps other people weren't finding gains. But undoubtedly, the sport has evolved so much in the last 10 years. I mean, it's not that long ago that we thought a sort of 40K solo break in a major race was just extraordinary. And now 80K is possible. And that must be because of the awareness and the understanding of the physical requirements of that sort of effort, and whether that can be replicated, whether it can be done, and whether it can be produced in race circumstances. And the data must have kind of unlocked the door to those kind of performances, right?
No, I mean, that's true. You know, I mean, I know we just keep going back to it, but, like, things like fueling for sure make that possible. Whereas in the past, you wouldn't have enough fuel on board to be able to do that, you know? I mean, for sure, data has a part of it. I mean, to be honest, the whole 80K break thing, if it wasn't for Pogacar, I don't know if we would still think this is possible, you know? Like, I mean, I don't know. Is it possible for everyone? It's definitely possible for him, but very few people, you know? So I think that's also just like an individual sort of thing. But for sure, like things like fueling have made an impact on that. And maybe that also comes from data that we know we can fuel as much as we can now. Data has a big impact. But I will say we also over rely on data, where sometimes I think we get kind of lost in all the data. I will say, okay, for example, we definitely get lost and distracted by some of the data, you know, like, I don't know, sometimes with teams, they sign guys purely off of their numbers, things like that. And then in the end, they just can't race their bikes. And then after a year or two, they're out of the sport. I think it's also knowing what data to use and what to take with a grain of salt.
I think the individualization of the data, that's another element that AI can tailor things to the individual based on an individual amount of data. I mean, Geraint Thomas made the point that in a when he was racing, all he had to worry about was himself and how he's getting on. But now he's got to worry about 30 riders, and he's thinking about the short-term goals and the long-term goals and keeping track on how everyone's doing. It takes quite a lot to just be across what everyone's doing, and naturally the focus is on the riders now who are going to hit the Giro d'Italia. You know, who's got their eyes on what's happening to the riders who maybe have objectives later on in the season, and just using some kind of predictive modeling just to kind of keep on top of what's actually going on, rather than just using the sight test, that, you know, the sort of guesswork, or just the feel factor, the old-fashioned, you know, the French director sportif kind of pinching the waistband of the rider to declare them ready for the Tour de France. I mean, that type of thinking has kind of completely gone. The other point he made about the numbers is that the sport is still highly individual, and riders were being hired purely on numbers, you know, Mark Cavendish probably wouldn't have got a pro contract.
Oh, 100%.
He would have been discarded way before that point. So it was really interesting to hear what they were talking about. And the one other thing I wanted to ask you about, Larry, was because this was something that Andre made, the CEO of Net Company. This is a part of a kind of global battle for data, and Net Company see themselves very much as a European competitor to the Chinese and US data companies. And I mean, he didn't sort of frame it in a sort of way of like Europeans fighting back against China and the US taking over data, but he definitely mentioned more than once the question of who owns data, and whoever owns the data will be in powerful positions. And this just made me think about the situation in last year's Women's Tour of Romandy. Do you remember, Larry, when the UCI wanted all of the teams to use a certain GPS system for safety, and the teams objected because of the data concerns? And there is a battle going on. Who owns the data? Who owns the riders' data? Who owns the team's data? Is that something you've ever thought about or had a concern about?
To be 100% honest, I really could care less about who has access or owns my data or where it goes. But I will say there are people that are way more informed than me that are very concerned about it. So, for example, in our team, we have a very brilliant data scientist that they hired this year who is extremely overqualified for this job, but he just likes cycling. So he started to work with our team this year, and he definitely put up a very big fuss on how little protection there is of our data in like Training Peaks, for example, or like Hexis, this nutrition app that we use. And then he pushed both of these apps to like actually give us much more data protection and security. And they did. To me, I'm like, whatever. I mean, I'm sure whoever wants to see my data have access. Anyone can access it. I'm sure the government knows everything about me. I'm sure the other people who are big in the data world can see everything about me, and to me it's pretty much a lost cause, so I'm just like, whatever. But maybe I shouldn't be so resigned to my fate.
You're not worried that, you know, they're going to find out how much pistachio cream you're eating and try and sell you some more of it.
Exactly. I mean it's possible. Maybe they'll hack into my nutrition app and adjust it and give me too much food so I'll get fat, but you know.
I mean, I do remember, I think it was when Peter Sagan was riding with Tinkoff, I think it was. They were trying to develop a kind of logistics app that would run all of the team's logistics. And I think at that point they were trying to then roll it out to other teams. But I got the feeling, even with the sort of off the bike aspect of whatever this Pulse software is going to do for Netcompany INEOS, you know, I would imagine that quite a lot of the data and the way the team is run, if it evolves in the way that they were suggesting yesterday, that data will become more valuable, I think. You know, data about past races, especially as we're getting into a position where now people may be able to identify what is worth recording and what is relevant and how that could shape tactics, how it could shape performance. I think it's a really interesting area, and I think it's probably going to be something that will have people's eyes glazing over or crossing, or, you know, the traditionalists will be up in arms at the idea that professional cycling is already remote controlled by the sports directors via radio, right? And we want more panache and racing on instinct and no numbers. I think the trend is that the opposite is going to happen, but does that necessarily mean that the racing will become, more sterile, more controlled? I don't know whether that necessarily follows, but it will be interesting to see how any developments sort of come on stream, because they did say that they would be looking at trying to introduce the Pulse system to the team as soon as possible. And they talked about winning the 8th Tour de France, the 6 from the Team Sky era, 1 from INEOS, and now they want to win an 8th in the next 5 years. I suspect they would have to sign Paul Seksas to give themselves a chance for that. One thing that really kind of leapt out was the absence of any talk about developing a women's World Tour team. I asked Andre Rogaczewski about that, and he kind of gave a slightly woolly answer and then sort of said, sure, why not? You know, let's see what's possible. But if they were seriously thinking about bringing a women's team into the Netcompany INEOS fold, you would have imagined that yesterday would be the perfect time to unveil it. And it does strike me that there's a missed opportunity there, because they could be talking about winning the first Tour de France Femme for the organisation as well. But, you know, let's see whether any of those plans come on stream in future years. The other question that I asked this morning, because we're still waiting for some kind of resolution to this investigation into David Rosman, the head carer who was linked to the German doctor, Mark Schmidt, who was involved in several doping cases in the 2000s. And this story kind of overshadowed the Tour de France to some degree for INEOS Grenadiers last year. And they announced sometime towards the end of the tour that there'd been an independent investigation commissioned to get to the bottom of what had or hadn't happened. And that investigation was started by an independent law firm last spring, but there has been no confirmation of whether that process is concluded or whether there's been any outcome, or whether it's just kind of kicked into the long grass, which I think is pretty disappointing when it comes to the PR gains of unveiling a huge new sponsor. And the guy from Netcompany was asked about the team, and he was very effusive about the performance and the ethics of the organisation. But while this David Rosman situation continues to hang over the team, I think it is unsatisfactory, and it will probably rear its head again at the Tour de France. But very lastly, on Netcompany INEOS, Larry, you'll have to look out for their grey-blue, green-grey jerseys.
To be honest, it just looks grey to me, but
It does look grey.
When I heard it was going to be green, I was like, oh, green would be nice. I mean, grey just like boring, yeah?
Well, apparently the Net Company corporate colour is a dark green, and the reason they haven't gone for that is because it clashes too much with the Tour de France green jersey, which is a dark shade of green with the Skoda sponsorship, and so they've gone for this kind of grey. Yeah, I must admit, it's not exactly zinging, but maybe it will stand out from the crowd. We reserve judgment until we actually see it in action at the Giro. And speaking of the Giro, Net Company Ineos will be going there with Egan Bernal and Timon Arensman. Filippo Ganna is set to be in the team as well. Magnus Sheffield and Ben Turner also mentioned. So they're going there with, I guess, top five ambitions on GC and stage win hopes. But we may well touch on who the early favourites for the Giro are in the final part, Larry. Well, Larry, the Tour of the Alps, another successful week for Tudor Pro Cycling. What is it about that race? Why, you had a very good year last year there, and same again this year?
Probably because it's our last sort of tune-up for the Giro, and both years we came straight from altitude, so we had pretty much the ideal, optimal preparation for the race, which I would say is not often the case, in the sense that, like, there's so many races on the calendar, it's hard to have optimal preparation for every race out there. And so it was nice. We had 3 weeks in Sierra Nevada. This year there were five of us. Last year it was three of us. And the five of us went straight to Tour of the Alps. It was pretty cool because, everyone was in pretty good shape, complimented by our Devo rider being even better, in better shape than all of us. So that was pretty cool. So, it was nice just to go there and, gain some confidence going into the Giro.
Yeah, Michael Storer, fourth for your team, Tudor Pro Cycling. Mathis Rondel, fifth, both going to the Giro d'Italia as well.
Yes, yeah.
So, and then Pellizzardi, Bernal and Arensman, the top three overall, and they will all be at the Giro as well. But Jonas Vingegaard will start as the pre-race favourite, I guess, although we haven't seen him in action for a little while. What did you make of Pellizzari in the Tour of the Alps? Is he close enough to challenge for a real high overall position, do you think?
I really believe he'll challenge for the podium. I think he was excellent in Tour of the Alps, but I don't think he was necessarily like so far and above everyone else, which is, for him, I'd say a good thing. You know, I'd say last year, the problem was Michael was too good in Tour of the Alps. He was far and away the best rider at the race last year and like on really another level from everyone else. Whereas this year, he was very good, but he was not too good, I would say. And I actually have to say, I feel the same for Pellizzari. While he was better than everyone else, I wouldn't say he was like three levels above everyone else. So I'd say for him, that's a good sign, because in Tour of the Alps, I feel like a lot of times when you have one guy who's so much better than everyone, it's not a good sign for the Giro. You know, I mean, usually it means like they peaked too soon. And I think that was the case with Michael last year. And so I was happy to see that he was good, but not at his best yet. I actually have to say, I think it was probably similar for Pellizzari. I think he was very, very good, but I actually think he could still improve. So I believe that he will fight for the podium.
Yeah, Daniel nicknamed Michael Storer Storachar last year
after the Tour
of the Alps. And expectations were super high going into the Giro, weren't they? But you're right, a little bit more under the radar. And Mathis Rondel has been on my radar since you mentioned him at the start of the season. I think in one of our very early episodes predicted that he would have a good year, so I've been keeping an eye on him. The other thing that happened at the Tour of the Alps was that Tom Pidcock won a stage, and he was kind of trying to fast track his recovery after that terrifying crash in Catalonia in March, opted to ride the Tour of the Alps to get some kilometers in his legs ahead of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. It didn't work out too well for him on Sunday. He had a mechanical problem at pretty much the worst time in the race. But Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which we covered in Arrivé, of course, on Sunday, brought the Spring Classics to a conclusion. And so it's the last instalment, for the spring at least, of Kurowitz Corner. It's a somber update from Hugo this week. We saw Tadej Pogačar pay tribute to his former teammate, Christian Munoz, at the end of Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday. Munoz was a Colombian rider who crashed a couple of weeks ago in the Tour de Jura, and he injured his knee, and that knee injury became infected. And he passed away on the Friday before Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and Pogacar wore a black armband and he pointed to the sky as he crossed the line at the end of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, paying tribute to Munoz, who had been a teammate when he first turned professional for the UAE team and played a big role in one of Pogacar's first big wins, the 2019 Tour of California. Well, Hugo's had some sad news from closer to home this week.
Pay attention, freebie. Well, spring is over. The riders have left my corner. Silence has fallen. And since Saturday evening, it has become unbearable. Let me explain. After the Colombian Cristian Munoz on Friday, Milan Brau lost his life in the Flemish Ardennes in a banal accident with fatal consequences. Milan Brau was 21 years old. He was an under 23 rider and lived less than half a kilometer from me today in Hoijem. He was the cousin of Sepp van Marke. Milan went to watch the race of his brother Siebe, who was riding the very first Grand Prix Dries Deveneens in Zoldzeke as a promising junior. Milan didn't make it that far. At an intersection near the Hotond, known from the Ronde van Vlaanderen, there was that fatal crash with a car. Hours later came the news that no one wants to hear. Milan Brau is forever young. His family, Uncle Sepp, Uncle Ken, who has a DS at EF Education, and the other uncles and family members are left or faint after this irreversible tragedy. Nowadays, this sport claims too many lives of young, healthy people chasing a nice dream. The fatal training accident in Ronse meant that I watched the very last monument of the spring on Sunday with mixed feelings.
Well, we echo the comments there from Hugo about the number of cyclists who are dying in different incidents, and pass on our condolences to Milan Brau's friends and family, and to Hugo too. Now, Hugo also recorded some thoughts about the Spring Classics, and we'll play that in the next edition of the 1101 Cappuccino, which will be out shortly. So, Larry, what was your Liège-Bastogne-Liège experience like?
Fortunately, it was not the best. It was interesting because for anyone who paid close attention to the race, it was a very unique edition. So already, it's a really hard start in Liège. The kilometer zero is at the bottom of like a 4 to 5K climb. And it's always super hard start. I would say in the past, so I've done it quite a lot of times, and every time the breakaway goes either just over the top of the climb or a little bit after. So I thought, okay, you know, I always try to start really in the front at kilometer zero so that you can sort of like sag the climb a little bit. So I did that. I started pretty far in front and I was just slowly sagging to try to save a bit of energy because it's a very long race. And I would say about halfway up the climb, about like 10 guys in front of me, someone just like opened up a gap and they just didn't hold the wheel in front of them. And then the gap just grew a little bit. But to be honest, personally, I wasn't stressed because I was like, well, I mean, someone's going to close it, you know, someone always closes it. And it grew a tiny bit more. And then I looked to my right and I saw Remco attacking from the second group to the first group. And I thought that was a really dumb move because I was like, this guy's already wasting energy with 260K to go and it's all going to come together, you know, like at the top of the climb. All of a sudden, the gap went to 30 seconds, 40 seconds, 50 seconds. Visma rode a tiny bit. Then they realized Pogacar was in the group, so they stopped riding. It went out to a minute and a half. UAE started riding. And then it went to 2.5, 3, 4 minutes. And then I was like, wow, maybe actually that was a good move by Remco. In the end, it's a really long race, and I was very confident that the best riders in the race would come out of the second group, because to go that hard from the start in a 260-kilometer race, as hard as Liège, I don't think that's a recipe for success. In the end, what it did do, though, is it made the pace extremely high for the entire day. Because, yeah, they were going full in the front, and then they had to go pretty full behind. Unfortunately, my race ended early because I also had a mechanical at a poor moment. And I changed the bike thinking it was a fine moment. And then Tim Wellens went full gas up the climb right after. So that was, unfortunately, a premature ending to my race. But it was super interesting to see how, I mean, it was the craziest edition I've ever done. I've never seen it raced anything like that before. And I don't think anyone's ever seen that, which also led it to be, you know, the fastest edition ever, like every other race this year, pretty much. I mean, I do have to say, I found it pretty cool to see Sexus able to challenge Pogacar for as long as he did. It would have been really cool to see them go into the line together, but yeah, I was super impressed by him, and I think it makes it exciting for, yeah, the future and for races to come.
Yeah, you said not the recipe for success, but it was the recipe for success, wasn't it? I mean, you were there at the Tour of the Alps last year when we first really saw Paul Sexas on the elite world stage. He was racing then for, as he is now, for Decathlon, but he was in that break with Nicolas Prodhomme, his teammate, the two-up break, and then he kind of gifted the victory to his older, more senior teammate. And I mean, it was we were speculating before the race whether the distance would be a factor for him being 19 years old, and there's a lot of talk about whether his age is particularly relevant in terms of the selection for the Tour de France. So we're still waiting at the moment to hear whether he will start the Tour de France. But I know it back in the day, you know, cycling was thought of as an old person's sport, really. The peak years were sort of 27, 28. A young guy in the Tour de France was 23, 24. I mean, there's a reason why the white jersey was awarded to the best rider under 25. I mean, under 25 now is not necessarily a young rider, is it, Larry? I mean, what's your view? I don't know whether this is just sort of armchair sports director in me here, but it seems to me that while cycling is still an endurance sport, of course it is, it's actually a lot more intense than it's ever been, and it's less attritional. And so this concern that young riders don't have the durability for a Grand Tour perhaps isn't as relevant as it used to be. I don't know whether that's just my kind of random made up theory or whether there's some basis to that.
No, I mean, I definitely think you're right. And, you know, not to go back to the same topic that I always go back to, but I swear, you know, half of it has to do with fueling. So I think the reason that they used to say, you know, especially for classics, they used to say, oh yeah, you know, you have to be 28, 30 to win a classic. And because you just don't have the endurance when you're younger. But the reason we didn't have the endurance was because we just didn't eat, you know, and we weren't fueling our training and racing properly. And so you'd go into a race, yeah, you'd always be underfueled. And I think it took years, maybe almost a decade, to just destroy your body into becoming a fat burning machine before, you know, and so you just went year after year after year of just essentially underfueling your body to the point that it became so good at fat burning that you were able to do a classic and perform at the end. That was just because it took that many years to become so good at fat burning and, you know, I guess become more efficient. Whereas now we just eat and we fuel the races. And now anyone can compete over that distance from pretty much any age because you don't need to destroy your body for 5 to 10 years into becoming a fat burning machine. You can just feed it carbs and all of a sudden you're able to perform even better. So to me, that's what has changed so much, both the classics and the Grand Tours, because we recover way better for the Grand Tours. And in the classics, you just eat like a madman on the bike. And all of a sudden you can do pretty much the same power at the end of 250K as you can at the start. Yeah, I don't think you're wrong. I think you're right. And I'm pretty sure it's the majority of it has to do with fueling.
So really, then it becomes a question of the mental aspect for Seksas and the weight of a nation, the expectation of France on his shoulders. And I don't think that's going to get any easier when he's 22, 23, 24. So I don't know. It's very easy for me to say nothing to lose, but it does seem to me nothing to lose. Because in a funny way, the expectation will be less on the first attempt at the age of that he is now. I think he may be 20 by the time the tour starts. Just have to check when his birthday is. Oh no, he'll still be 19. He's not 20 until September, the end of September. Incredible, isn't it? Yeah, that expectation, you know, no one would kind of see it as any kind of shortcoming or failure if they sort of withdrew him from the race midway through, you know, first rest day, or you know, perhaps the next big mountain stage after the first rest day, see how he goes, and say, well, we've dipped our toe in now, and we've exposed him to some of the expectation and the pressure and the stress, and you know, that's that's a decision for Decathlon, but it would be fantastic, you know, if you're talking about how to get people engaged in watching the sport this summer, especially younger people. And we've been talking about this a lot this year, you know, cycling always seems to be peering down the road for another type of audience coming. Here we've got a teenager, 19 years old, smack bang in the demographic that all of the stakeholders say they want to attract. It would make perfect sense to field him in the Tour de France and get him on TikTok after every stage. That's the way.
His team, at least 2 years ago when I was on the team, was the biggest team on TikTok, according to them. So I think you're right. They are already there and primed to attract the demographic.
I mean, if they can't appeal to young people with no attention span with the Mur de Huy and Flèche Wallonne, cycling's got no chance. I mean, it's 3 minutes long. I mean, even the most the most distracted person can concentrate for 3 minutes. Just clip up Seksas riding up the Mur de Huy, set it to music, some graphics over the top. We've unleashed cycling on the future generation. Larry, you made the point about the Tour of the Alps being these days the big preparation race for the Giro d'Italia for a lot of teams and riders because of its, well, the terrain and the position on the calendar. It really has overtaken the Tour of Romandy, which used to be a sort of final point of call for some riders going to the Giro d'Italia, but that's not been the case for a long time now, really, because it's so close, isn't it? But the Tour of Romandy is underway. Dorian Godon of Ineos, they're still Ineos Grenadiers, won the short time trial, which kicked it off on Tuesday. They're underway racing until Sunday. Larry, you ride for a Swiss team. You probably have very fond memories of racing in Switzerland because your biggest pro win was at the 2017 Tour de Suisse in Villars-sur-Olonne, which is not far from where they'll be on Saturday and Sunday in the Tour of Romandy. Now, I was a little bit unkind about the race because it leaves me a bit cold. I don't know whether it's because it looks too pristine, Switzerland, at this time of year. It's too green. It's too beautiful. It's the open spaces and the kind of lack of humanity. You don't see huge crowds there. But sell the Tour of Romandy to me and racing in Switzerland in general.
I mean, I can't sell you the Tour de Romandy because I hated it the two times I did it. So I think I did it
because?
In 14 and 15, and both were miserable experiences. I mean, when I did it, it was like the weather was terrible. When the weather wasn't terrible, my allergies were terrible, and I just never felt good. So two races on the calendar that I just never, ever enjoyed were Tour Romandy and Tour of the Basque Country. Luckily, I only did Romandy twice. Tour of the Basque Country I had to do like six times or something. And as much as I love the region, Basque Country is incredible. I mean, I just always got smashed. So can't say I ever enjoyed it. Also for similar reasons, weather being terrible and allergies being terrible. But I will say Switzerland is incredible. And for me, it's one of the most beautiful countries in the world because it's like everywhere you go looks like a postcard. I don't think you can actually find a not beautiful area in Switzerland, or you'd be hard-pressed to at least. And yeah, the French region of Switzerland is equally beautiful. I mean, I will say I had nice experiences there, even when I didn't enjoy the race. I always enjoyed Tour de Suisse. Maybe it's a different time of year. Maybe I was always in better shape. But yeah, I mean, beautiful country. Yeah, amazing landscapes. It's always well run, I would say. All those races are very well organized.
The roads are fantastic.
The roads are incredible. You can't get better roads in Switzerland. Yeah, nice climbs, but they're super hard. So I can't say I'm selling anyone on Tour de Romandy. But okay, let's say I could sell it to them also. It's like slightly more accessible as a World Tour race because it has a little bit, well, okay, this year it's Pogacar, but usually the start list is a little less strong than some of the other World Tour races. So potentially there are more openings.
Pogacar riding this week does add another level of interest. We'll see whether he manages to tick that one off as he's kind of collecting races like a child collects stickers for their Panini World Cup sticker album, isn't he? He's not got too many gaps to fill. But I wouldn't say this reference may be lost on anyone under about 45. I wouldn't say the Tour de Romandie is a shiny. Now, a shiny is like the special sticker that usually has a foil finish on it. You know, the Tour de France would be a shiny, obviously. Maybe my discomfort with Switzerland, it's so pristine. I always feel like I'm making the place look untidy just by being there. So perhaps that's why I don't fit in too well there. Anyway, it is not long before you have to get yourself to Bulgaria. Had you gone on a recce holiday to Bulgaria, Larry, like you did with Hungary?
No, Albania, but no, never.
Oh, sorry, Albania.
No,
wasn't
all
it?
Good.
Yeah.
Never been to Bulgaria. So I have to say that actually excites me because, you know, after being in sport for so long, you've been like a lot of places. So it's still cool to check new ones off. Yeah, off the list and experience new cultures, new places. And yeah, it's interesting to race a bike. And especially when you go a few days early for a grand tour, you get a little more of the feeling of a place. So I'm actually pretty excited to check it out.
Yeah, I had hoped to make a weekend trip to Bulgaria, but sadly not. So I'll be watching on TV. Daniel Freiber will be there, of course. He will be covering the Giro from start to finish. The 10th anniversary of our first daily coverage of the Giro d'Italia. 2016 was our first for podcast, so it's a long old stint. And well, you're in good shape, the team's looking good. Can you see much beyond Jonas Vingegaard as the winner of the pink jersey when it reaches Rome in a few weeks' time?
I mean, probably not, to be honest. I think he's definitely the big favorite. I hope there will be an interesting battle for the podium.
Well, we know that João Almeida, who had at one stage been penciled in for the Giro, he won't be riding. He's not had a great season so far. Lots of illness and injury problems. Mikel Landa also out of the Giro with a fractured pelvis from Itzulia in the Basque Country a few weeks ago. There'll be some other team changes, I'm sure, as we get closer to the start in Bulgaria. And Daniel will be back next week with the Giro d'Italia preview and a whole week of episodes leading up to the Giro before our daily coverage starts. And while I'm just promoting a few of the things that we've done lately, last chance to listen to Sexy Basque, which is Daniel's episode made at the Tour of the Basque Country, focusing on Paul Seixas, who won the race, the first Frenchman to win a World Tour stage race for, well, almost Seixas's lifetime, because it was back in 2007 when he was still in a nappy, I expect. So Sexy Basque is currently in our free feed and it will be moving behind the Iron Curtain onto our Friends of the Podcast feed. Thank you to all of our Friends of the Podcast for supporting us, signing up, enabling us to make these episodes and make them available to everyone to listen to for free. But if you haven't listened to it by, I think, the end of Thursday, it will be available to Friends of the Podcast subscribers. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And Daniel's other extravaganza, part one of Meltdown, which tells the story of the 1986 Peace Race, which was the big amateur race held in Eastern Europe when East and West were still split by the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall. And it took place just 10 days after the Chernobyl nuclear power station disaster, the biggest nuclear disaster in history. And the start was in Kyiv, which was only about is only about 90 kilometers away from the Chernobyl power station. And there were debates at the time about whether the race should have gone ahead. Daniel's two-part series, Meltdown, unmissable. Give it a listen. Fascinating story, brilliantly told. Again, that's available for people to listen to for free, and then it will go onto the Friends of the Podcast feed in a few days, maybe in a week's time before the Giro starts. And then it will be all focus on the Giro d'Italia and the race for the pink jersey. Larry will be there working for Michael Storer and guiding Matisse Rondel through his first Grand Tour.
First Grand Tour, yeah.
Any tips for him? What would be your the first big tip? You know, 10 days out from the start of the race.
Matisse, don't take too many risks because he descends very, very quickly. And I don't know, already at training camp, I had to tell him to take a few less risks in the days leading up to the Giro because the objective is the Giro, not going fast in training before, you know. So probably be a bit conservative on the risk taking is my number one advice for him because he does everything else quite well.
Excellent. Well, we'll look out for him. What would be a good Giro for Tour de Pro Cycling? Stage win, I guess,
definitely a stage win because I don't think our team has won a stage in a Grand Tour yet. So that would be our first big objective. And I mean, I would say it would be successful if we placed one guy in the top 10, but I really believe we could place two. I mean, if we had a perfect Giro, we'd have one in the top 5, one in the top 10, and a stage win. And I think that's possible. For me, that's possible. I think Matisse, if he keeps going the way he's going, he can be top 10. And I think Michael, if he really reaches his best form, he could be top 5 if he has good luck and not too many crashes or anything.
Well, we'll be following the Giro daily. Daniel Friebel will be there, of course, be joined by Michele Palacci, Brian Nygaard, and others. And Larry, I no doubt you'll be popping up on an almost daily basis to talk us through your Giro as well. I hope you will anyway. Best of luck there with the Giro. Thank you very much for joining me today. I hope it's been okay. I feel a bit like, you know, when you go out for a drink with someone you know through someone else that you both know much better. Yeah. I feel like it's been a bit like that. But I feel like we closed that gap a bit today,
Larry. No, it's good.
And although the listeners can't see this, I don't know whether you can notice
on the wall behind me, there's a bike. Don't worry, that was the first thing I noticed. The chain's back on.
The chain is on the bike, yes. Larry pointed out that the bike hanging on my office wall and the chain had been off for a month, and I joked that it was a sort of metaphor for my kind of state of mind and general dysfunction at the moment. And I put the chain on just for you, Larry.
Thanks.
Anyway, thank you very much for joining me. Fascinating to hear all of your perspectives on the recent racing. And, the riders will be safe from the AI takeover, at least. I'm still working on AI Lionel Burney to do the podcast. Maybe
irreplaceable.
Make him a bit more cheerful than the real thing. Anyway, I'll be taking a break for the next few weeks while all of the focus is on the Giro d'Italia. I hope everyone enjoys listening to it. Daniel will do a fantastic job again. So why don't we get in the Giro mood by playing out with our theme music, Cozze by Amara Terra. Thank you, Larry.
Thanks, Lionel. And thanks, everyone.
Ci gira nella delle giardine che la raccolgo con l'acqua e l'ovina. Faceva l'uovo tutta in mattina, ci c'era nella teneva vallina, faceva l'uovo tutta in mattina. Faceva l'uovo tutte mattine. Ci giuro della teneva tiella, faceva l'uovo con la mozzarella.